Welcome to the TAHA/TDH weekly COVID-19 call. My name is Hilda, and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Chris Clark. Chris, you may begin.
Thank you, operator, and welcome to our weekly call with the Tennessee. Another week now that we're doing this, excuse me. We appreciate having Dr. Amelia Keaton and Dr. Mary Margaret Phil from the Tennessee Department of Health to provide some updates. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Phil.
Thanks, Chris. Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. I first just wanted to share a few updates on general numbers and trends in Tennessee, which many of you are probably aware of. So quickly, just a brief snapshot. As of 2 p.m. yesterday, we have almost 58,000 cases of COVID-19 reported in Tennessee. We saw an increase of about 1,600 cases yesterday, and we are now at 710 deaths in the state. A few other sort of relevant trends. I think most people are aware that we've seen a fairly precipitous increase in our case numbers in the last couple of weeks. Last MMWR week, we recorded close to 10,000 new cases in Tennessee, and that was a fairly large increase from weeks prior. We're sort of tracking along a similar trend this week. That MMWR week timeframe runs from Sunday to Saturday. So we'll see. We still have two more days this week to see what our weekly numbers end up being. We're of course closely watching not just the number of positive tests, but also, the geographic distribution of cases, the rate of rise. We're looking closely at testing data and the percent positivity of tests as well. We've seen that testing has continued to uptick quite a bit, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in just a minute. In the last week, we've had about 135,000 new tests reported to the state, which again is a fairly substantial increase from weeks prior. We're now averaging close to 20,000 or so new tests per day on average, which is up fairly substantially over the last couple of weeks. In accordance with that, we're also looking closely at our percent positive, as I said. And we've seen, if you recall, in mid-June, we made a small update to how we were presenting our laboratory testing data, so it's really only appropriate to compare these data back to that point, since there was sort of a methodology change. But on June 12th, our sort of cumulative percent positive was 5.7% of tests. We've seen that gradually uptrend over the last several weeks to today, where we're sitting at about 6.9% of our tests are positive cumulatively. When we look just at the last 14 days, we see that just over 9% of our tests are positive, around 9.3%. So I think piggybacking on just the general numbers trends, I think many of you are probably aware that we're seeing increasing laboratory turnaround times. Commissioner Piercy and Governor Lee spoke to this briefly at their press conference this week. This is a problem that's not unique to Tennessee. However, we're seeing that many of our large commercial laboratories are either exceeding the capacity of specimens that they have to process per day, or they're starting to prioritize specimens. So we've had to do some shuffling of our own local health department testing to shift to some other laboratories, and we're closely tracking those laboratory turnaround times for many of the commercial labs to determine if we can potentially optimize the specimens that we're collecting, although we're seeing that most labs are experiencing prolonging turnaround times. That obviously really complicates our public health actions. If we don't get results back on a patient for 5 days and then they're not reported to us for another day, we're looking at potentially a week plus before public health is even attempting to contact a case, almost nearing the end of their isolation period. So, these are real challenges that, unfortunately, I don't know that there are any perfect solutions for right now, but I do want to acknowledge them and recognize that they're challenges that we're trying to brainstorm and troubleshoot to improve however we can. I also do just want to mention in terms of data trends, I think as most of you are aware, we've added some additional statewide hospital data from Hertz to our website. So we're now reporting the number of hospitalized patients. Again, this is just at the statewide level. We're not breaking down by ICU or ventilated patients. It's just the total number of admitted patients. We've, of course, seen that data uptick fairly substantially in the last really 10 days or so. As of yesterday, we had 842 COVID-19 patients admitted in hospitals in Tennessee, up from 501 on June 27th. So a fairly substantial increase, not surprising that there was a lag there, with the increase in cases that we've seen over the last several weeks. We're also starting to see a slight increase in deaths being reported. Throughout most of the pandemic thus far, we've been averaging somewhere between 5 and 6 deaths per day. We're now averaging closer to 7 to 8 deaths per day. So we're, of course, watching that very closely as well. And then we are also now reporting, again, at the statewide level, publicly, the number of available floor beds, ICU beds, airborne infection isolation rooms, and ventilators statewide. That, of course, as that number has ticked down a little bit, our available floor beds is now at 18%. We've gotten some questions around that we've tried to answer as clearly as we can, recognizing that there are many factors at play in what's driving those availability numbers. With the current number of hospitalized patients, we're sitting at about 8% of all of our hospitalized cases. All of our hospitalized patients in Tennessee are COVID patients. So certainly not what we're seeing in some other states where that number is much higher, but it is definitely an increase from less than 5% or so that we had in prior weeks. And, of course, that varies greatly by geographic area of the state. I think those are the big data updates I wanted to provide. I do, again, just want to remind everyone, especially as we're seeing these increasing laboratory turnaround times and some additional delays in public health outreach to cases, again, just advocate that, we appreciate any partnership that, frontline clinicians and healthcare facilities and institutions can provide in providing patients when they're diagnosed with COVID about guidance around isolation requirements and guidance around information that they can give to their close contacts. I think we've shared it before, but I'll send to Chris after the call the links to all of those one-pagers that are available on our website, both in English and Spanish. And again, as much as we can direct people to those resources and make them aware of what the expectations are, and even if we can just ensure that a handful more of people are aware that they should be staying home if they are potentially at risk of an exposure, every little bit helps. So to the degree that you guys can help be our eyes and hands and feet on the ground to disseminate those resources when possible, we greatly appreciate it. And then, as always, there's a plethora of other resources on the website, a few of which we might highlight later. So I think those are the big things. I'll turn it over to Dr. Keaton for her updates.
Thanks, Dr. Phil. So hi, everyone. My name is Amelia Keaton. I am the interim director of the Healthcare-Associated Infections Program, if y'all have not heard from me previously. I will just highlight something that Dr. Phil just said regarding isolation and quarantine precautions. I think there's been a little bit of confusion, likely due to the changing guidance from CDC over the past several months. So we are still asking that any contacts of an asymptomatic COVID-19 case, anybody that was in contact with that case for 48 hours before diagnosis until 14 days after their last exposure to quarantine. So I think some providers have given guidance previously that if a person was not symptomatic at the time that they were in close contact with them, that it's unlikely that they were contagious. And I think we all are now recognizing just how big of a role asymptomatic transmission is playing in the spread of COVID-19. And so I would just encourage folks to continue to do that provider education and continue to remind folks that, even if a person is asymptomatic when they're infected with COVID-19, they're still able to transmit it to others. I also wanted to highlight a piece of CDC guidance that was actually released several days ago, but that was not broadly, I think, publicized, and that is the new recommendation that anybody who is a healthcare provider in an area with moderate to substantial community transmission wear universal eye protection in addition to their mask when they're caring for patients. And that is regardless of whether the patient is suspected of having COVID-19 or not. The reason for this new guidance, and I actually followed up with CDC just to make sure I understood it correctly, is that, you know, again, we're seeing a lot of asymptomatic people with COVID-19 transmitting it. We've also seen a lot of instances where people who are not suspected of having COVID-19, maybe they were visiting a hospital for some other reason, whether it be an injury or a chronic medical illness that they were getting care for, they were screened and actually tested positive. And CDC's guidance for healthcare workers with exposures to COVID-19 patients has said for a while now that if you are a healthcare provider caring for a patient who is not masked and you are not wearing eye protection but were wearing all other elements of PPE, that, you know, in an ideal situation, you would quarantine at home because that exposure would be considered high risk for becoming infected with COVID-19. And so, you know, the goal of eye protection is to protect those mucous membranes from small respiratory droplets that can contain viral particles from entering your respiratory tract. It's also meant to discourage you touching your eye area or rubbing your face when you are wearing it. And it also is meant to just provide an added layer of protection if you're caring for patients that you may not know have COVID-19. CDC did not provide a whole lot of firm guidance on what was considered moderate to substantial community transmission. They did kind of reference that if you're in a place where there are large-scale outbreaks or multiple cases from the same location, that that would be considered moderate to substantial community transmission. I think in Tennessee, it's pretty safe to say that we are, in an area with substantial community transmission. And since this is really just meant to be an extra safeguard to our healthcare workers, I think it's reasonable to consider implementing this guidance. I also just kind of wanted to point out that, you know, concurrent with the rising cases across the state, we're also seeing more cases and more outbreaks in long-term care facilities. You know, many facilities that previously had had clusters or outbreaks of illness are seeing new ones. Areas where there was previously low levels of community transmission are seeing, you know, new outbreaks in long-term care facilities. My team is trying to ramp up our capacity on the infection preventionist front to respond to these as quickly as possible. We're trying to explore outside resources, too, that can really try to support these facilities and limit transmission as much as possible. But just wanted everybody to be aware of that. I think, you know, as of earlier this week, we had seen 27 new clusters identified in long-term care facilities. I imagine the new list that we received today of these clusters will have even more added to it. But just something that we are monitoring very closely and that my team is trying to work with these facilities very closely to help limit transmission and also provide more education on things like personal protective equipment and environmental cleaning and other measures that they can take to help decrease transmission between employees and residents. And finally, one thing I wanted to briefly touch on is the guidance released from the WHO yesterday or the statement from WHO yesterday acknowledging that COVID-19 could potentially be transmitted through the airborne route. And so that would be very small to minuscule respiratory droplets staying suspended in air for a prolonged period of time and being capable of infecting others. I think this is something that had been suspected or investigated, and it's continuing to be investigated. I think we've seen instances in primarily enclosed indoor spaces with poor circulation, so places like bars and very crowded congregate events, where there is suspicion of airborne transmission. I think the amount to which this is happening is still not necessarily understood well, but I do think that it's something that is, you know, we are going to continue to see more evidence of. I think it's less of a concern in places like hospital settings that have a high number of air exchanges per minute within the facility just by building codes and that sort of thing. But I think it's just another, you know, another reason to take every precaution that we can in terms of wearing masks when going in public, in avoiding, you know, enclosed spaces with a lot of people, maintaining social distances, and washing your hands regularly, and washing and cleaning your environment regularly. More to come on that, I think. And I believe that's all I have right now. Unless Mary Margaret, do you have anything else you'd like to share?
Nope, I don't think.
All right, thanks. I will turn it back over to you, Chris.
Thank you both for that update. Operator, if you would, if you'll share with the audience how to get in the queue to ask a question, please.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 using your touchtone phone. You can cancel your request by pressing the pound sign or hash key. And if you are using a speakerphone, we recommend that you pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Again, for any question, please press star 1. We're standing by.
So, Amelia, while we're waiting to see if what questions come forward from the audience, would you just clarify again the statement around when you're exposed, when you have a known exposure to someone who tests positive, even if that person was asymptomatic, what that individual is to do?
Sure. When we're looking, we're doing contact tracing for anybody who tests positive for COVID-19. We typically ask the person to identify anybody that they were in contact with or close contact with for the 48 hours before they tested positive. And if, you know, it was an instance where the person tested positive and didn't get the results for several days, we'll also ask for them to identify any close contacts from that date of testing to the date that they were notified of the result and quarantine themselves. So we are basically asking folks who are, even if they are those close contacts of asymptomatic people, we're asking them to self-isolate or quarantine at home, even if the person was asymptomatic, because they may have becoming, you know, infected by small respiratory droplets. So we've heard kind of anecdotally from some providers that they have instructed close contacts of asymptomatic people not to quarantine, and we just wanted to reemphasize that that is not the correct guidance. They're still at risk for being infected and still at risk of spreading the disease to others. So even if your contact for the case was asymptomatic, we're still asking you to quarantine for 14 days from the time of that exposure. Does that make sense?
I think it does. I think the other question that comes up there is, should that individual be tested? And if so, should they quarantine regardless of the outcome of that test for the full 14 days, or if they test negative, are they cleared?
Yeah, so I would say they could, you know, the testing part is a little bit difficult to answer, just because it would be hard to determine when they should get tested if they don't have any symptoms. I think regardless of whether they get tested or not, they should isolate for 14 days. Even if they get a test and it's negative, they should still complete the 14-day isolation period. And the reason for that is, you know, we've seen many instances where people have gotten a test, it was negative, and then within 48 hours they develop symptoms and they have a positive test. So I think it's really difficult, particularly since we know, you know, a relatively high percentage of people with COVID-19 never develop symptoms. I think it's really hard to instruct somebody when to get a test, unless they have symptoms. And so I think the guidance would likely remain the same in the instance of a negative test or no test at all, that they should quarantine for the full 14 days. If they end up getting a test anyway and it's positive, then, you know, I think the guidance is a little bit more simple. You need to stay home for the minimum of 10 days after that positive test result. So a lot of different time frames presented there, but I think, probably the take-home message is if you are exposed, expect to stay home for a minimum of 14 days.
Thank you. I do think that guidance is confusing for a lot of people for another reason.
Yeah, no,
so thank you for that.
I confuse myself when I say it regularly. So if anybody has any questions at all about that, don't hesitate to reach out to us. We can kind of walk through the scenario and give some more tailored guidance to the situation.
Right. Thank you. Operator, do we have questions in the queue?
We do. We received a question from Alan Lofton.
Good afternoon, or good morning. This is Alan Lofton at Murray Regional Health. I have a comment and then a question. On the face shields, you need to know that the supply is extremely limited. We're having a very difficult time finding good quality face shields for our staff, so just an FYI. Second, on the testing, reagents are becoming more and more difficult to obtain, both for our in-house testings and for the external labs. Is there any thought that at some point you're going to pull back on stop testing not asymptomatic patients so that we'll have enough reagents for all the other patients that really need to be tested?
Yeah, so that's certainly been a topic of intense discussion. I think undoubtedly we will, more vocally encourage, more strongly encourage rather, those obviously that have symptoms, those that of course are hospitalized and others, should receive prioritization for testing if possible. I think we're trying to be thoughtful about the messaging there just because that is sort of a change over time. And I think fundamentally we still like the idea of folks being able to be tested if they want to get a test. But we understand that the reality is that means that folks that are higher risk or in the hospital or in a long-term care facility or others may have to wait longer for their test results, and that's not really great. So I think that's been a topic of increasing discussion with the Unified Command Group. I can't speak to all of those conversations, but I know that they're aware of those concerns and challenges. We're having many conversations at the state level with laboratories across the state and understanding their current capacity, their current limitations, and what they think their next 2 to 4 weeks looks like to try to understand, where we're going in the future. So I appreciate your point and insights. We completely understand and hear you, and we'll work to adjust that messaging in the coming days and weeks.
And I'll also speak to the face shields. I completely understand that they are in short supply, and just want to emphasize that it is, a recommendation. It's certainly not a requirement. And there is some pretty decent guidance out there on reusing face shields and reusing goggles and those sorts of things. That could potentially be an option. But I just wanted to make sure that we, pointed out that guidance was out there and that, we have been receiving some questions about it. So just wanted to make everybody aware that was, a new guideline and really just a new, an added way, to, try to protect our healthcare workers. But again, I know that all elements of PPE are still pretty short. Don't want to discount that shortage in any way.
We have another question. It comes from Juanita Holland. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. My question has to do with when does the 14-day quarantine period start? We had gotten some previous information from the CDC stating that the quarantine period started after the exposure to the positive case had an improvement of their symptoms. And my understanding is that has changed. So now I just would like some clarification on that.
Sure. So the guidance has, in my understanding anyway, has always been it's 14 days starting with your last exposure to the case. And so in a lot of cases, if it's a household contact or somebody that you are in contact with regularly, you may actually end up being in quarantine longer than the person who is infected. And the reason is that, if they're, on day 9 of their illness, they're still capable of infecting you with COVID-19, or there's still the possibility that they could infect you with COVID-19. And so the idea is to just limit your exposure and to others while you're in that period where you could be incubating the virus or could be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic. So you are correct. It's starting at the time that you last had exposure to the case, not necessarily the date that the case was diagnosed. So if a person was diagnosed with COVID-19 on a Monday and you had contact with that person Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, your quarantine would start on that Wednesday, because that was the last time that you were in contact with them. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you so much.
Okay. No problem. I know I feel like sometimes I'm talking in circles when I go through all the days because it's just, it's not necessarily intuitive. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Izzy Hall. Please go ahead.
Yes, this is Clissy Hall at Vanderbilt. Dr. Phil, would you go back to the last set of data points that you walked us through, the floor bed capacity, ICU beds? I didn't quite get all of that down. And then there was a comment about percentage of patients with COVID who are now hospitalized. I think it was 8%, but could you walk us through that?
Sure, yeah. So I can send out the link. All that data is available on the website. I'm happy to repeat it, but also you can access the link and bookmark it so that you can check it updated. That's all updated daily. So right now we're sitting at about 18% of floor beds are available statewide, as well as 18% of available ICU beds. 71% of ventilators are available. So, and as I said, we've seen an increase in hospitalized patients, COVID patients over the last couple of weeks. As of yesterday, we're at 842 patients, which is an average of about 8 patients per hospital reporting. That's an increase from around 520 patients in late June. That only represents about 8% of all hospitalized patients in Tennessee.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
That data is not explicitly available, I guess, but you can look and see how many beds are occupied and just do the math
right.
to figure out
right.
what portion of but hospitalized that, patients are COVID.
The ICU bed availability, did you just say 10%?
18.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate
no problem.
We also received a question from an unidentified line. The area code is 931, so if this is your phone number, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Scott from Cookeville. If I understood correctly, the positive test statistic given was 9%. Do we know what percent of that 9 are symptomatic? And the other concern I'm hearing out of some of the local medical staff is false positive versus false negative with actual cases with the person who is grossly symptomatic in a household testing negative and the asymptomatic testing positive on the same day. Do we know or have any estimate what the false negative positive rates are on the testing? Because there seems to be less confidence in the outcomes as this is ongoing.
Sure. So I said that in the last 14 days, our percent of tests that were positive is around 9.3%. Cumulatively and to date in the pandemic, our overall percent of tests that are positive is about 6.9%. We do collect data during our case investigations on symptoms. I have not looked at that data in the last couple of weeks or week or so to know, you know, updated numbers on what proportion of cases are symptomatic. I would also caution that, you know, we collect that data at, a single point in time. So, there's a lot of discussion still, I think, at the international level about, what proportion of cases are truly asymptomatic versus what proportion of cases are tested when they're sort of pre-symptomatic and that ultimately go on to develop some symptoms in the preceding, you know, 2 or 3 days, because there's undoubtedly a mix of both. Certainly there are some patients that never develop any symptoms, there's no doubt of that, but there are also people in that other bucket, and so our data is not necessarily going to be able to to granularly capture that spectrum, although it is helpful as kind of a single snapshot in time. So I'm happy to take a look at that and report back maybe on the next call in 2 weeks on that data. Your points about false positives and false negatives are certainly well taken. You know, I think it's impossible to give an overall percentage number because those data points vary fairly greatly depending on what test you're talking about. You know, for example, there was a lot of publicity around some of the point of care tests that have come on the market, the Abbott ID Now, and then there was a fair amount of concern about a relatively high false negative rate for that test. Similarly, you know, we're seeing an increase in availability of some of the antigen tests. And so while those are certainly more helpful in terms of diagnosing acute infection than antibody tests, their sensitivity is much lower. And of course, there are always, you know, factors around, you know, the adequacy of specimen collection and other things at play with regards to potential false negatives. You know, with regards to false positives, at the state, we treat every positive as a positive unless there is clear evidence of a laboratory contamination event. So, and I will say we've had several of those that we've learned of at commercial labs. We've even had one or two at our own state public health lab. I think, you know, most big commercial laboratories or reference laboratories are very well protocolized. They can, if there's any concern about a false positive, they can go back and do quality testing on those samples. They can look at, you know, logs and reference values and fairly quickly determine if there's a problem. And I will say, again, at our state lab, in the one or two times that situation has occurred, they were able to tell us definitively, you know, within 24 hours or so that they believed that those results were a false positive. So, you know, most laboratories should be able to do that sort of investigation if there is that concern. However, in the absence of, you know, again, some known laboratory error or issue, we treat every positive as if it's a true positive, in large part because the potential public health ramifications of assuming otherwise are far greater than the impact of isolating someone that, you know, isn't truly infectious. Not to downplay the impact that that has on a person and their life and their family by any means, but in sort of the broader, you know, public health perspective, we would much rather err on the side of caution and assume that every positive is a true positive. And in general, I think the specificity of most of these tests is very high. There was much more doubt raised around a lot of the serology testing around false positives, in large part because many of them cross-reacted with other seasonal coronaviruses. You know, I think there's less of that with the PCR testing, although most of the PCR tests look for several, at least two targets, and often one of those targets is not necessarily specific to SARS-CoV-2. It's sometimes a target that could also be found in the original SARS or another coronavirus. So all that being said, you know, again, a false positive we would treat as a positive. If you had a household contact of someone that is symptomatic, but they test negative, we would count that as a probable case in our case definition, and those cases get treated exactly the same as a confirmed case in terms of their isolation and contact tracing and quarantine of their contact. So to us in public health, it doesn't matter quite as much if the test is positive or negative. If they're symptomatic and had contact with someone that was a positive case, regardless of that person's symptoms, then we would consider them to be a probable case and take the appropriate public health action. So does that answer your question?
For the most part, yes. Thank you. The follow-up data in 2 weeks would be great if available.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to try to pull that together.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from another unidentified line. If your area code is 224, please go ahead.
You guys, so I actually have two questions. The first is around the face shield. What I'm understanding the change is it's now suggesting universal use of eye protection beyond just the staff in our facilities that are with COVID patients. So this would be the non-COVID med-surg kinds of units as well, correct?
That's correct, yeah. So the guidance, I think, is meant to provide added protection in addition to a surgical mask whenever you're seeing any patients, so ones who are there for potentially non-COVID reasons.
Okay, very good. And then second, I am just curious if you all are recommending or providing guidance around routine testing, again, for healthcare providers that are taking care of COVID patients.
So we haven't made specific recommendations for this. You know, I think some facilities are doing this proactively just because they have the ability to do the testing in-house and it's relatively easy for them. But I think for a lot of facilities, it's just not feasible, unfortunately. And I think if you feel like somebody's had a pretty significant exposure, then maybe that would make sense. But I think doing it routinely for all employees, it would probably be a bit of a stretch right now for most people. So it's not something that we've released specific guidance on, but we have heard, you know, anecdotally that some facilities are doing this.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just,
no problem.
This is Dr. Phil, I would just emphasize again, and I know you guys are all probably so sick of hearing this and sick of telling it to your staff, but I would just emphasize again, if widespread routine testing of staff, you know, isn't feasible, which I think it's not for many of the reasons that we've already talked about, including just increasing laboratory turnaround times and increasing volumes of testing. Just stressing to staff that if they have any symptoms, even if they are nonspecific or not running a fever, that they should strongly consider being tested. I personally know of several situations in my own family and friends circle for many folks who are healthcare workers where they've had potential exposures at work because people came to work sick for multiple days before seeking care. And that more than anything is, I think, what's the most frustrating and an area where we can just continue to improve folks, you know, staying home and getting tested to ensure that there's not potential exposures there.
And I'll also just emphasize, you know, again, what Mary Margaret said, but also just that a lot of these PPE recommendations that are quite different from what we do during normal times are also meant to kind of reflect that, are also meant to hopefully minimize the risk of employees getting exposed to COVID-19 and also potentially spreading it to others if they're working with COVID-19 and are asymptomatic. So, you know, obviously, I think, you know, in a perfect world, we would be able to test everybody, you know, regularly and get results back, you know, immediately, which I think is just unfortunately not the case. And I think for that reason, it just really is critical to make sure that staff understand, you know, how to wear PPE correctly. You know, I know that it's short and that is, you know, really, really unfortunate, but I do think that trying to make sure that staff are comfortable with the PPE that they do have and that they know how to appropriately use it and also just know how to do very basic things like washing their hands, which I know everybody on this call has probably provided instructions on ad nauseum, but I think it's, you know, those are some of the best safeguards we have for COVID-19 and for spreading it.
Thank you. We have a question from someone from area code 865. Please go ahead. Participant from area code 865, your line is open. Perhaps you're on mute. We will go to the next attendee. It's from Kristen Bland.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for your comments. We greatly appreciate it. It seems that universal masking seems to be the current way to contain and manage COVID-19 and has found success in other countries like Italy, Germany, and China. I was on a call yesterday listening to a Dr. McCary from Johns Hopkins, and he stated, although universal masking is proving the best way to contain the disease, not all masks are created equal. And I think in our hospitals, we're using the highest grade of effectiveness with N95s all across the state. However, my question is, in regards to the public and messaging with the public, with some big decisions being made on, you know, schools and, you know, how schools are going to proceed, is the Department of Health providing any kind of recommendation in terms of, you know, what types of masks to wear to the public or for the decision makers with, you know, schools and businesses and things of that sort?
Yeah, this is Dr. Phil. I can take a stab at that. So you know, I think you're absolutely right, and, you know, the comment from Hopkins is certainly accurate that not all masks are created equal. We know that, you know, masks used in the healthcare setting are, you know, undergo much more strict assessments and determinations of their ability to protect against certain pathogens and particle sizes versus, you know, the wide spectrum of masks and bandanas and other things that we see being used by the general public. So, you know, I think right now there has not been a lot of discussion about standardizing or formalizing, you know, requirements for a mask. You know, to be frank, I think we're just trying to get people to wear masks, regardless of what they're, exactly what they're made of. And I think while masking is undoubtedly going to be important, you know, I think what we also saw in all those other countries was masking combined with ongoing social distancing, you know, aggressive and adequate testing capacity, and contact tracing and isolation. And so, you know, I think, those other factors cannot be sort of underplayed in the importance of preventing and decreasing at least ongoing transmission. So, you know, right now I think the first step is just trying to improve our uptake of masking. You know, it's highly variable across the state. We obviously see that many of our metro counties have instituted masking mandates or requirements. And that in several other counties as well. We've had other counties come out and say that, you know, they're not going to put forth any sort of requirement. And I think, especially for some of you, and depending on what part of the state you live and work in, you may see quite a bit of masking or you may see hardly any masking at all. And I think there's still quite a bit of misinformation. There's still quite a bit of doubt and mistrust in the guidance, for just masking at all. And so our first step at the state level is to try to combat those myths and misconceptions and try to improve the uptake of masking in general, recognizing that I think any type of mask will help. Undoubtedly, some types of masks are going to be even more effective. But if we can get, you know, basal levels of masking in many communities across the state combined with ongoing social distancing, and other appropriate precautions, and I think we will see transmission start to decline. Now, if we get to that point and we can start to be a little more picky about exactly what masks people should wear, then we'll certainly cross that bridge. But right now, I still think we're in that first bucket where we have to first just get more widespread uptake to even attempt to start to see some of the benefits from more widespread mask use.
Great. Thank you.
And we have a question from Jared Warden. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you. If you could speak briefly to the changes in the remdesivir allocation distribution that's going to be happening starting next week.
Yeah, I actually might defer that to Chris. Chris, do you have any insights on that?
I have a little bit. I don't have all the details that the questioner may want, but the process, at least, has been generally defined by the federal government that the distributor, AmerisourceBergen, will be the direct distributor of the allocations for purchase and will distribute directly to the hospitals. The determination of what that amount will be is based off of hospitals entering data directly into HHS teletracking portal on their cases and probables and hospitalizations for the prior 2 weeks. So this past Monday, hospitals had to report by close of business into that teletracking portal. That information was compiled by HHS and then sent to the State Department of Health, and Paul Peterson at the Department of Health is overseeing that currently, I'm sure with input from others. And then based on that distribution, he will let AmerisourceBergen know what the allotment will be per hospital based on your experience. I do understand from a communication yesterday they've asked for it to be denoted in 40 vial cases because that's easier allotment size for them to ship versus individual patient courses, which is what we did previously with our Vanderbilt allocation system for the free remdesivir. So my understanding is as of today, the Department of Health will share the allotment information back to AmerisourceBergen, and then as soon as we have that, know that, AmerisourceBergen will be in touch with the hospital directly to say, this is your amount, and here is the invoice if they have a relationship with you and you wish to purchase it, or if you don't have a relationship, that you'll need to establish one. So that's the information that I currently have, and I'm hopeful that we'll have a little bit more information that we can share specifically from the team at the department overseeing that later today or by Monday. And then that process will repeat every 2 weeks, so through September until the allotment is fully allocated for purchase through the that distribution method.
Thank you so much.
I can also tell you that as of this morning's report from Vanderbilt, we have approximately 17 days based on current utilization requests this past week of the, quote, free remdesivir, or the donated remdesivir available. So until that supply is exhausted, hospitals can access that and request that based on the clinical criteria through that REDCap system. Once that's exhausted, then, of course, we'll only have the opportunity to purchase it. But the most recent data from today's update from Vanderbilt was that there was approximately a 17-day supply left. It's currently already been used at 54 hospitals for about 848 patients so far.
At this moment, I show no other questions. As a reminder, you can press star 1. We have a follow-up question from participant area code 865. Your line is now open. You may go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Amanda Jolly from Turkey Creek Medical Center. I just have a two questions. On the mask for the public, even though you don't have a specific material that says, what about those masks with exhalation valves that seem to have become popular?
Yep. So this is Amelia Keaton. We are discouraging the use of those. So the exhalation valve masks were primarily created for people who are trying to protect themselves against air pollutants or chemicals, so they have been used in industrial settings for a while. The mask essentially eliminates the source control component of it, though, so you're still exposing others to your exhaled respiratory droplets. And so we're really, when we get questions from healthcare facilities, this is where we've gotten the most questions about this. We are discouraging their use, and CDC actually discourages their use as well.
Is there any type of information on the Tennessee Department of Health that, as public schools open, that they could use, as a reference to that discouragement?
We could certainly make that, I think. Mary Margaret, do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And actually, we've developed sort of a one-page guide around some of the basic data around masking benefits, and we could certainly add a piece to that that clarifies that type of mask is not recommended.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the other question I have, just to follow up, is the best time of testing. I know that's a difficult one, but there was a news report locally on one of our TV stations, and it actually was, I think, interviewed a Vanderbilt physician talking about when people have symptoms, and they were, the article was around, you know, the symptoms for 20 to 30-year-olds being more of a headache, GI stuff, but to waiting till about 4 days after a symptom start, is, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, many of the studies that have looked at the highest level of the presence of viral particles, you know, find that that sort of is very high at the beginning of illness, often starting even, you know, a day or two before symptoms start. You know, from a public health perspective, we would rather know that someone is positive earlier than later. If someone is potentially infectious for 2 days before their symptoms start and they wait 4 days until they get tested, and the average incubation period is 5 days, then by the time they're getting tested, their contacts from 6 days ago could already be developing symptoms. So we basically already lost our ability to contain spread from that patient if they wait that long. Now, that undoubtedly happens sometimes, but I don't know. From my perspective, if someone has symptoms, they should seek testing. I don't know that they need to sit home for 4 days to try to maximize their likelihood of positive tests. Again, potentially just, it's one thing if they want to stay home and completely isolate themselves, but if they're going to go about their lives and put others at risk, then that seems a little bit silly to me.
I agree. Thank you so much. That'll be helpful for us. We now are beginning to see more healthcare workers sick. So thank you.
Thank you. Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. At this moment, we show no other questions in queue.
Great. Thank you, operator, and thank you all for asking those questions, and to our speakers for your candid and helpful responses. Any closing comments, Dr. Phil or Dr. Keaton, before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just say thank you. I think many of us have felt I keep using the word disheartened is maybe the best word. This has been a challenging few months for many of us, especially those of us in healthcare and public health. And I think some of the increase in cases and behaviors that we're seeing in some communities is a challenge. And I know that all of you and many of your staff are working tremendously hard now, you know, closely watching bed availability and status again. Kind of getting back to a place that we didn't really want to be in. But we greatly appreciate all of your partnership, of course, the partnership with DHA, and just can't thank you enough for all of the hard work and care that you provide to your patients, to your communities, and being a partner with public health throughout this ongoing work. And we understand and feel many of the frustrations and strains and stress and concerns that you all have, and are hopeful that brighter days will be ahead. So, Dr. Keaton, do you have anything?
Yeah, I will probably say this less eloquently than Mary Margaret. I will just say I know I am tired. I know everybody on the phone here has got to be tired, both from a personal level, because I know not being able to go and do the things you want to do during the summer is incredibly hard. And then also just from a professional level, you know, I think sometimes we overlook how hard it is to have patients who are critically ill or dying. You all have had to do and see things in the past 6 months that, you know, are incredibly hard on an individual patient level, much less having to do it day in and day out. And I just want folks to know that I recognize that. I wish I had something more meaningful that I could say, but please know that we're here to try to support you as much as possible. I may not have the best answer or the most eloquent answer a lot of times, but I will do my best to try to help support in any way that I can.
Thank thank you both. I just want to echo from the association standpoint our gratitude for all of you on the phone and especially our partnership with the Department of Health. We have found both of these individuals and their teams extremely accessible. So if those of you on the phone have concerns or have questions and need to reach out to get clarity around recommendations or how to manage a situation or an exposure at your facility, don't hesitate to reach out, and they will be extremely responsive. Following the call, we will distribute the extra guidance and the links to that guidance that Dr. Phil described to help with worker exposure and mask and those types of one-page education opportunities for both our staff and our communities. So, again, thank you to all of you on the phone, and we appreciate your time. We did record the call, and we always do, so if you would like, we'll make sure that that playback opportunity is available if you need to share it with others on your team. So, again, thank you all for participating, and this concludes today's call. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's call. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.